Welcome to Cybersecurity Where You Are, the Center for Internet Security's podcast. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO at CIS.
And I'm Tony Sager, Senior Vice President and Chief Evangelist at CIS. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we're online at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or running a state or local government.
So join us on Wednesdays as we discuss trends and threats, explore security best practices, and interview experts in the industry.
Together, we'll clarify these issues, creating confidence in the connected world.
Hello, and welcome to the show, Cybersecurity Where You Are. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO here at the Center for Internet Security, joined by the host with the most, the difference maker, the Hall of Famer, Mr. Tony Sager. How are you, sir?
Hey, Sean. It's great to be back with you. Thanks for the kind intro.
Absolutely. And we are joined by CIS's Chief Operating Officer, Gina Chetman. Gina, how are you?
Good. Great. How are you, Sean? Hey, Tony.
Doing great. Thank you. Gina, why don't you start us with your, I think it's now 12, 13-year journey here at CIS. Is that right?
Yeah. Yep. You're right on. It's I think it was 12 years in November of 24. So we're heading towards 13.
Lucky for us. How about that? So, Gina, why don't you take us through that journey where, you know, the groups that you've been in developed, and I'm sure that there's organizational change that you've seen in 12 years, respectfully.
Oh, absolutely. As you know, and I certainly as Tony knows, when I started back in 2012, I believe I was the 50th or 52nd employee of CIS. So, you know, fast forward to today, I think we're about 500. So very, very different organization, very different scope of work that we were doing and ultimately impact that we were having. So I started at CIS in our SOC. And at the time I was making a career change. So I came in after about 15 years of running restaurants and retail businesses. So I spent a decade and a half or so doing that and wanted to get into cybersecurity. I was really interested in it. I had a lot of management experience, and so came into CIS in the SOC and quickly worked my way up into a management role in the SOC. So at the time, we had the multi-state ISAC, couple thousand members, and we had one side of the house, which was our SOC and our operations supporting the multi-state ISAC, then we had the other side of the house, if you will, which was our benchmarks at the time, CIS benchmarks. And that's really kind of, that was it. There was these two groups. We didn't really know each other that well. We didn't really understand what each other did, but we had these two groups supporting, you know, both SLTT, US SLTT, and then the broader global community, of course, with our benchmarks, which is what CIS was ultimately founded on. So at that time, again, very small organization, really two functions with our support functions, you know, our corporate functions like finance and human resources and IT, et cetera. So I was in our operations center. I spent in that, what is today known as operations and security services. So I spent about 6 years there. In the 6 years that I was in OSS, as we refer to it today, it's had a number of name changes over the years. So I'll just say, I'll use today's terminology. I came up through management roles, and when I left OSS at the time, I was serving as a senior director of operations. So, and in that role, I oversaw a number of teams, our incident response team, our engineering team, our SOC analyst team, our data analytics team, our vulnerability management team, which does penetration testing and vulnerability scans, and our cyber threat intelligence teams. So those were kind of under my umbrella of responsibility. In those 6 years, we grew pretty significantly. We first, trying to think of, it's hard to be chronological sometimes when you're going back that far, but I'll give you the gist of, you know, what we accomplished, which I think is will lead us into some of the conversation on the operations and how we form our products and services for our communities. We developed, piloted what today is Albert, which is an intrusion detection system, so an IDS. We had started Albert at the, when I had first come on, and it was really just monitoring, capturing NetFlow data. We quickly realized and then recommended with our partners at DHS CISA that NetFlow was only so valuable. So we wanted to pilot it as an IDS using open source software. So we ran a pilot with Albert as an IDS with a number of states. very successful, very effective. And then we wound up rolling that out to all, offering that to all of the states as part under our CISA funding. So we did Albert, we kind of built it, operationalized it, tested it, piloted it, and then rolled that out. We also at the time managed devices for states. So meaning our funding originally prior to Albert was to provide two devices per state, any two devices the state wanted. And we partnered at the time with Symantec, so they were the back-end provider, so they collected the logs and did the log ingestion, tier one analysis, and our team did a tier two, tier three, and did all the reporting and interaction with the states. Most states at the time chose firewalls, commercial firewalls, or commercial IDS IPSs. So that was the original. Then we moved into Albert. Then we offered Albert to the states. We also stood up the elections infrastructure, ISAC, in that 6-year timeframe. So that was, something that we worked closely with the elections community on and DHSS as well to stand up that ISAC. And basically built out the operation and the infrastructure to provide these products and services to state and local governments. There's a myriad of other ones that we built out and operationalized in that time. But I would say the elections infrastructure, ISAC, and the Albert Network Monitoring, the IDS capability, were the two probably most significant initiatives in that time.
Wow. I mean, most people would call that a career. You call it 6 years, but that's fine.
So that was 6 years, and then yep. ISAC was continuing to grow, and there was a lot happening, of course, and CIS was continuing to grow. So at the time I left OSS, I went into the chief of staff role. So I took the chief of staff role. That was around the time that, and CIS was expanding, of course, this whole time. So that was around the time that we stood up what is known today as sales and business services. So sales and business services was stood up, which consists of sales, marketing, communications, business development, sales operations. That was being built out by a senior leader that was brought into the organization to do that. So that was happening. I was serving as chief of staff. We had a few leadership changes in the organization at that time. Right around my year and a half mark of chief of staff, John Gilligan, who was previously chair of the board, came in as CEO. When John came in, that was the first time that we had a competitive recompete on our cooperative agreement. And so we put a lot of energy and effort into that. I led that initiative and then wound up going back over to OSS to lead it as the senior vice president, the full business unit. So the part I had led previously was the operations side. We also had a stakeholder engagement side. And that's a pretty large team that interacts and supports SLTTs. So I stepped back into OSS and I spent about a year or so, year and a half there, working with the team, you know, really dealing with some of the, I would say, growing pains of the huge expansion of the ISACs, both the MS and EI ISAC. We also at that time rolled out our MDBR service. So that's our malicious domain blocking and reporting service. We also rolled out endpoint detection and response, EDR, for the elections community in that time. So I stayed in OSS, got those things off the ground, number of other smaller items, and then spent some time went over to sales and business services, which again was about 2 years old, I would say, at that time. And I wound up leading sales and business services for, I want to say, 2 years or so in my time in sales and business services. Now, I didn't pause at this point in the timeline, if you will, and Tony's really good with timelining, so he can always interject, but in those, you know, now we're at 10 years or so. In that time, we had CIS had built our Secure Suite offering, which are tools around our best practice content. We provide that nationally and internationally, so kind of really built out that product. We also provide that product to U.S. SLTTs at no cost. So really an expansion of that whole kind of business and operational model, if you will. We also, in that time, rolled out what are known as hardened images, which are kind of virtual images of our benchmarks that are provided on cloud service provider marketplaces. So we partner with all the main cloud service providers to offer those to their customers. to their marketplaces. So all of these things, I'll say in like one sentence, but clearly there's a lot of operation and business and work that goes around both building and launching and then maintaining and expanding those offerings. So in my time in sales and business services, we were growing pretty quickly. I think we had hit 3,000 commercial customers or members of our Secure Suite product offering, in addition to the U.S. state and local governments that receive it at no cost. Our cybersecurity services organization, which offers Albert, our network monitoring, for fee to SLTTs, was expanding pretty rapidly. Today, it's about 1,100 organizations that purchase that from us, in addition to those that receive it funded under our federal funding. And during my time in SBS, I also built out, and when I say I, that's the collective we, we built what is now today known as a cybersecurity services organization, which was to expand the services offered specifically to US SLTTs. So we rolled out our endpoint security services offering. We launched that in 2022, in the fall of 2022. And we also launched in 23 the malicious domain blocking and reporting that I already referenced under our cooperative agreement. There were a number of asks from our members for some additional bells and whistles, I'll call them. So we launched the ability, very, very cost-effective way for SLTTs to purchase that, those additional features, if they so desired, in addition to what they would receive just under the MDBR offering. Then I took the role of Chief Operating Officer in the fall of 23, and I've been in this role since. I know that's all over the map, guys, so sorry about that. And there's a lot that happens in 12 years in an organization that goes, as you both know, from 50 employees to 500 employees. So those are some of the highlights I'd call out.
Yeah, that's a bit of a whirlwind tour of both the Center for Internet Security, your life, and the industry in general, I think. And I think one of the things that strikes me, Gina, is you sort of came from the world of management, business, you know, made a choice to shift into the, you know, techie, grunty business of operations. And then, but you've never left, right? It's sort of the interplay between how do we help people is not a purely technical question. It's a mix of sort of how do I make things available to them, either from the market or in a way that is affordable to them. And so there's constant like swinging back and forth between the technical need, the business opportunity, right? We still have to keep the company going, even as a nonprofit, but also looking at the cost effectiveness of solutions, right? As opposed to how do I maximize my profits? How do I maximize the impact at the minimum cost or the most acceptable parameters to all the state and locals that we deal with? So I think that's, and I don't know that you get to slow down. I think you're going to keep cycling back and forth around these things. And I remember coming on board in the 2015, to bringing the critical controls into the company then. And at that time, it was still relatively small operation. You know, we're in the less than 100 people, something like that. And just watching it and going, you know, and I was used to gigantic operations, you know, coming from the federal government, you know, just massive things. But it was fascinating. And you alluded to growing pains, and there are growing pains. I want any warning for others, because I often said my federal career, my most challenging times were fast growth times, not slow growth or no growth or downsize. But any hints for others? Because it seems like, you know, in one of the things you had when the company was small was a tight culture. People knew each other, right? You all sat in a room. You could look at each other. You knew their motivations, et cetera. And for me, the reason I found fast growth challenging is because, you know, you're spread like dramatically thinner, spending a lot of time absorbing new people, and you're trying to preserve the things you like about the company, you know, the culture, the closeness, the camaraderie, the common mission, and so forth. So tell us about sort of that cultural change aspect of what you saw and how you helped avoid some of those problems.
Sure. It's a great question, Tony, because once we started really expanding and experiencing this rapid growth many years ago, it was top of mind to the leadership team, the head of the organization, and the board of directors that our culture was one of the things that really allowed us to do what we were trying to do, to help to allow us to achieve our mission and to stay on focus with that. And it was the culture of the organization. So I didn't mention that during that time also, we developed what we refer to as our leadership principles. And we didn't just develop a bunch of leadership principles and say, okay, let's post those on the wall or put them on our website. We embedded them into everything that we do. We embedded them into our hiring processes and recruiting. We embedded them into how we review, how we are reviewed as individual contributors or as leaders, people leaders in the organization annually. So ultimately, it was not what you do alone. It was what you do and how you do it. And so I think that was not just that we developed them and we embedded them, that it was also the support and the focus on those things of leadership and all the way up through our board of directors. It really sent a message down and across this organization of how important that was to CIS, that we maintain that culture. We also have always really focused on being a mission-driven organization, right? So mission, it's always mission first. So it's mission first. And when we bring people in, it's really interesting, frankly. I've recruited so many people from the private sector over the years of being here. And one of the number one things I could say I hear across all of those interviews is I really want to work at a mission first organization. And CIS has such an amazing reputation of being that type of organization. So I think from a cultural perspective, that those are some components, but we have expanded on that over the years. You know, we have a CIS Cares group. It's all volunteer from across the organization, where we do philanthropic activities to support our communities, both in and outside of technology. We provide 40 hours a year to every employee at CIS to volunteer anywhere they want. It could be with CIS Cares and what we offer through that, but it could also be just in their local communities. We provide a very robust set of training opportunities, professional development, really making sure that we're giving, not only we're reskilling or upskilling our people for this industry, but also for what their career objectives are. So that is also, you know, that all of these things, there's so many, I mean, I could list and list and list. I was a HR employee, I'd probably be able to call out, you know, 20 or 30 things, but there are so many different things that we do that all speak to the culture and then maintaining the culture of the organization. And then for your first part of your question, though, what I'll say is, and here's a tip that I learned. Sometimes we learn things the hard way, but the important thing is we learn them. Because of the rapid growth, like you were saying, and change being probably one of the more difficult things organizations go through. So maintaining your culture is a crucial component of that in your long-term strategy as an organization. But it's also change management. And I think that people use the term and they use it like just because it's a buzzword, but it is the people side of change. So the best thing you can do is to make sure that you're communicating. There's communication coming up, going down, it's lateral, it is, and you communicate over and over and over. What are we doing? Why are we doing it? What is your perspective on that? What questions do you have? What can you offer to this type of change? And as we've come through the years, we've gotten better and better at focusing on what I call it, what is the soft side of change, the people side of change. And if you want to be successful in rapid times of rapid growth, I think that that is probably where you would be best served to put energy and focus.
Yeah. And a lot of that, again, didn't exist when I came on board, you know, not around 10 years ago now. And, you know, it takes a massive investment of energy and resources and time. You know, I think it speaks well to the importance and the recognition of it, as you said, by the board, by the leadership, to say, look, we're going to make that investment. We're going to spend the time. We're going to invest in people. There wasn't even a formal training program of any kind, I think, when I came on board. You know, and I often describe us as proudly old-fashioned. You know, that is, I grew up in an environment where, you know, you take a green kid out of college and you say, well, I'm going to put you in a 3-year internship. We're going to teach you the ropes, give you some classes, learn from the masters. And that seems to have fallen out of favor pretty hard in the last several years in the industry, right? People are much more mobile, companies less inclined to invest. And yet here we are fighting the trend. We're going to invest heavily. And there's a belief there. One is we want people to be successful, but also we want them to feel like we value them. And therefore, they're more inclined to both do good work, but also to stay with us. And I think history says that that's been a wise choice for us. As you said, mission-driven. You know, I grew up in public service. My dad was a public servant, so you know, never knew anything different. And one thing I appreciate is the chance to have that same feeling in my second career, right? To feel like we're talking about how do we make a difference in the world. And by the way, we still have to run a business. But at the end of the day, we're all about making a difference. Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. Okay, well, as we keep growing, I hope that all works out. we're tuned now to the cultural traps here. By the way, I once worked for a boss. I won't say I've been places where they didn't get it right, where I had the big boss, and I was two notches down, but sitting around with his table of direct reports, and he looks around the table and he goes, "I think we have a culture problem here," and he turns to one of his direct reports. He says, "Your job to fix it. Go." Oh. And it's like, oh my God, I think this is already doomed.
Right. That'll doom it.
Yeah.
It's everybody's job. You know, some people are just more naturally skilled at, you know, having those types of what I would call soft skills. It's just, you know, some people have innately, they're strong in the soft skill area, and that's fine. And for people who aren't, that's okay. But you have to just be able to be introspective and understand what the value and importance is and put some focus and energy into it. And that's where I think, you know, our leadership team proper has really met the challenge, if you will. And by no means am I saying, Tony, you know as well as I do, and as does Sean, there's hiccups. There's hiccups along the way. But the point is that you acknowledge them. How do we get better? And it's really kind of, if you think of it, almost like an agile mindset. You try things. Pieces of them work. Pieces of them may not. Maybe it wasn't perfect. Maybe it was. But you just constantly iterate on that. And the goal is just continuous improvement.
Definitely. And with that, we'll be right back after this quick break.
Most organizations want to streamline their cybersecurity and compliance efforts.
It's just not always easy to do so on your own.
That's where a CIS Secure Suite membership can help.
It provides benefits, tools, and resources designed to help you implement the CIS critical security controls and CIS benchmarks.
SecureSuite can help you strengthen your cyber defenses, comply with common standards, and cybersecurity frameworks, all while saving you time, money, and effort.
Apply for membership today by visiting cisecurity.org.
Start secure and stay secure with CIS SecureSuite.
Thank you, and let's jump back into the episode. So Gina, one of the things, I'm going to reference an archetype, what I'm going to call the operational playbook, and ultimately in your role. And one of the things that I've seen in the organization as well is in a lot of cases, you've contributed to the design necessarily of how business units are structured, creation of new business units, respectfully. Now, what I ask is kind of a two-parter, but the first part is, given the fact that you were able to utilize that knowledge across the organization, get that experience, do you think the organization would look differently if you didn't have that context? Because in a lot of cases, you do what I'll call in a day is context switching. As you speak to many different business units and you kind of have to be conceptual to what they're thinking about, right? Or how they think, and then bringing this operational playbook to life is, okay, you know, what am I going to talk about? Risk, security, privacy, things like that. And, you know, you'll talk with other different business units. How useful necessarily was it to get that vision of the organization and work through many different business units?
Enormous, enormously useful for me in my role, in any role, frankly, that I've been in. There's a huge amount of value to understanding what it is to, you know, these different roles or different components of any given program. Like what, if I'm talking to the CISO, I know what Sean is focused on. And then I have to, you know, relate that to this program. What, how does that relate contextually to this program? But then also when talking to the people running the program and the staff, it's also making sure they understand the context. Why is this important? You know, yes, we have to launch this thing or we have to build this product or service, very important, but why do you care as a program lead what's going to happen on our operations side when they have to maintain and sustain that service? What's going to happen with our MarCom team when they have to be able to describe that service or sell that service in certain contexts? And our CIO organization, our engineering organization. So it's being able to understand contextually all of those different components or attributes, and then making sure that I'm communicating them in a way that is relevant to the audience I'm speaking to. So it's been huge value to me. And, you know, one of the areas that, you know, being a COO or being a very operational person, title aside, is I love the weeds, love them. I love being in them. I love understanding all of it, everything that happens down here, and really kind of going through analytically and saying, okay, how can we be more efficient? How can we, you know, better ourselves for the betterment of our mission or our staff? But in the roles as I've come up and around the organization, you have to come up out of that. So really the ability to understand them, to have that context, is so important to me. I'm a big context person. You'll hear me say the word a lot because I believe context is pretty much everything. But being able to take it up here and now apply it, you know, more strategically, more broadly to the organization. And you know, when you're a very in the weeds, operational, boots on the ground people, like, I have immense respect for the boots on the ground. I know exactly when we're making decisions as a leadership team, there is sometimes a substantial or significant impact to our staff and our team that are doing that work, that are going to be charged with maintaining that for the future. And so I like to be very thoughtful about decisions that I'm going to recommend or make as a senior leader with the context of the people that are going to actually execute that work every day and operationalize that. So it's been immensely valuable. I can't speak enough about just really being able to be in every, you know, these, all that you're saying, all these different people I speak to throughout the day, every day, and really being able to understand their perspective. And of course, make sure they know I want to understand their perspective. But then where you, then you struggle sometimes and you say, okay, is this material? And I have a lot of conversations with mid-level leadership in the organization, and they joke with me sometimes because they'll start saying it back to me. Yep, Gina, I looked at that. I looked at that, but it's not material. I said, ah, good. Because, you know, that's part of coming up into a leadership role, is understanding, like, hey, all of these things are important. They're not important, but are they really material? Are they going to change the outcome? Are they going to change the approach or decision? Or is it just more data? Because sometimes it's just overwhelming amounts of data you can take in. And really being able to take that, synthesize it into, okay, what are the most important things for our success in this endeavor, and being able to convey that. So yeah, it's been very valuable, and I think really important to my role to be able to have worked across CIS and kind of understand all the different components.
Definitely. Well, because you mentioned change, and I think integrating that as part of the playbook operation. So as you mentioned, you're mentoring or working with mid-level management to bring them up to, here's how to frame and necessarily contextualize the questions. What's important, right? Because in some cases, Gina, respectfully, there's only so much time you have in a day. And over time, what you've, you know, done with me and others is, this is what I need to know. Here's how we make a decision. Here's how we integrate that into a change process and communicate, right? All part of, necessarily, I see this playbook being generated. And it really is amazing that it's both tactical and then it leads to strategy, which is, I mean, it's just a complete kind of life cycle, as it were. Was that on purpose? Did you create it that way? Or was it this just, look, I've been in the trenches for 12 years. I know exactly what we need to do. Here's how we work with each group. And again, respectfully, as you mentioned, communication, people receive communication differently. Again, you have to contextualize your approach. Is that a fair statement?
No, it's 100% fair statement. And, you know, I think where I learned that lesson is the first time in my life is I was tutoring calculus in college. And when I operated as a tutor. And what I learned in that time was really, I could say the same thing to you and to Tony, and you could perceive it very differently. And you could be able to kind of actualize it, yay or nay, depending on how you communicate. How do you take information in? And so what I usually do, and kind of a method to part of my madness, I guess, is when I'm working with somebody, certainly for the first few times, my primary objective is really gauging, how's the best way to work with this person to communicate? How do they communicate? Because I want that relationship to be effective. Because if we can have an effective communication with each other, we're more likely to have a successful outcome to whatever we're working on. So again, I'm a big context person. I'm a big emotional intelligence person and soft skills. And I think those things in combination with having, you know, an analytical ability or understanding technology, et cetera, are really important. And when I share the first 10 or 15 years of my career, I was direct customer facing, right? In all of those roles, I interacted with customers all day long. Yeah. And yes, I ran the business and I trained staff and I recruited. I did all those things, but understanding like the voice of the customer and understanding now in this role, meaning in my time at CIS, the market, right? So this, it kind of all leads to strategy as opposed to, you know, me being so intentional to say, I'm going to focus on strategy. It's really kind of just kind of comes together. If you focus on all of these different components of any given thing, what is the market? What is our mission? What are the customers saying? How are they responding? How do we operate? And once you start bringing all that data together in your mind, you ultimately are, I think, able to understand, you know, or have strategic recommendations for the organization.
Yeah, I think, you know, that one of the things I appreciate about the way CIS has evolved, right? And some of the evolution was not by design, it was by serendipity, right? Things that happened, the formation for Benchmarks, the ISAC, the controls. But it gives us this diversity of missions and skills, insight into the marketplace, right? So it's one of the things that, you know, when I was working in government at the National Security Agency, we were a professional advice-giving organization. You know, we produced the moral equivalent of CIS Benchmarks, but to the government and all kinds of things across a really large front. But we had a 24/7 operational mission too. Red teams, I had blue teams operating around the world. We part of the early cyber watch at NSA. And so when you have all that, you see kind of the chaos and the complexity and the noise of the environment. But you also have the people that stand back and look at that. What's the root cause here? What's the best solutions? You know, and being able to juggle all those. And I said that kind of the third part is watching us grow from a pretty casual IT operation to we're a significant IT company now, right? Worldwide presence, lots of complicated partnerships, work from home, all the modern kinds of things. And so we live our own advice also. So I think that that diversity of both things that we do, which draws different kinds of people, different experiences, opinions, and relationships with the outside, I think is one of the most powerful things about the CIS business model. And I think, you know, you're one who has tried to translate from one to the other, I will say, right? The understanding of operations into what are the business models that we could generate to help the end clients, specifically state and locals. Can you give some examples of sort of how what did you look at? Like our, when we make other commercial services available, we don't just make them available. You do a lot of work to fine tune them, right? To think about what the real need is and what the ability is of the customer to absorb them in the state and local.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the top line, Tony, great segue is you learn about what the challenges are for your community, your membership. So in this context, we'll talk a little bit about state and local, because I think those are some of the services that best lend themselves to answering your question or having this discussion with you. What are the challenges the SLTTs are facing? What are the solutions available to them for those challenges? And why are they still being challenged with so many solutions out there? And maybe In and of that, there are too many solutions. How is it being offered to them? Is it cost effective? Is it operationally? Can they consume it? So ultimately, I'm a little bit of a disruptor by nature. So I've never approached or worked with a team at CIS to approach things as, okay, this is what you offer. How can I procure that and then just offer it to my community? No. Like, I want to break it. I want to break it because what you're offering, it's too complicated. There's too much of it. It's just you overcomplicate things and it's not cost effective and there's so much there. And I think you coined a term years ago, the fog of more. That really always resonated with me because that's exactly what it is. More, buy more modules, buy more capabilities, buy more types of support. It's just how does a state and local government, especially a smaller or a cyber underserved organization, know how to make sense of all of that? So a couple of examples that come to mind for me are We were looking for a domain blocking service, right? We knew in working with our membership, there's high security value in this, meaning if you could just block the outreach, especially with the advent of ransomware and how it was just blowing up globally, but even in the state and local government community, if we could just block that outreach to that command and control, right? Just that one thing could provide so much value and protection for the organization. So, and this was at the time when I said I went back and ran OSS for a while. This was one of the things we wanted to offer. We wanted to offer because we knew there was value. We knew it was being offered on the market. And we knew that the state and local government community were looking for something simplified. So we tested a bunch of solutions and understood, you know, okay, how are they sold? How much do they cost? What comes with them? What do you add on? How do you actually set them up? And we actually did our own pilots internally to kind of figure it all out. And once we kind of done that, we did that. We said, okay. And we went to the two largest global providers of this service and said, will you skinny it down? All we want to have SLTTs have to do is change their DNS IPs. That's it. And then be protected. That was a critical component of us doing this and partnering with the commercial sector. Will you take what you offer and all these myriad of bells and whistles that come with it and all the different things that they can buy and just skinny it down to the security with logging? That was really important to ask of the state and local government community was the logging piece of it. They didn't want it to just go in the ether. They wanted to be able to get some level of reporting of what was going on in their networks. So after a lot of conversations and testing and negotiations with the vendors, we wound up partnering with Akamai, and they built us exactly that. So that was, 4 years ago, maybe 3 years ago. I think we have almost 4,000 organizations being protected by that service today in state and local governments. And all they have to do, Tony, is change their DNS IP resolvers, and they get the security. Now, like I said, we built out an enhanced version of that state and locals can purchase if they'd like. If they want some of the bells and whistles, we honed in on that as well. But really thinking about how can we simplify it? How can we make it cost effective, but still be effective in the context of what we're trying to offer? So the domain blocking was one of the things we did. The other one that comes to mind, I mean, there's so many with the Albert IDS, really, we completely flipped that model head. But with our endpoint security services, so that, because this is another partnership scenario. So Albert is all us, right? We own the whole thing. Whereas with the domain blocking, we partnered with Akamai, and with our endpoint security services offering today, we partnered with CrowdStrike. But how is endpoint sold today to SLTTs? Well, to the market proper, but I was really focused on the state and local governments in this context. So I worked with a lot of our members and they provided me all the data, right? They said, all right, Gina, here you go. This is what we're being offered. We can buy this and this, and we can buy it in GovCloud, or we can buy it in the commercial cloud, and we can buy support, and we can buy monitoring. We can not buy monitoring. We can buy into, I mean, there's just 1,000 ways to buy it. And it's so confusing. It's like, but what do you really need? So when we first went to market with this offering, we built an offering. It has everything. You buy one thing, and you get the software, you get the administration, you get the management, you get the monitoring, the analysis, the reporting, the 24/7 support, and the 24/7 obviously monitoring as well. All you get everything in one purchase. It's very clean and very easy to understand. And then we do like we did with the domain blocking. We add things on. We can add things on, and we can say, okay, hey, if you really want, you know, additional modules, right? You want to be able to have identity, like IDAM management module, right? Sure, we can add that. We get asked from our membership. We can add that as an add-on, but really kind of simplifying the offering so it meets the needs of the community in a cost-effective way. So now also utilizing kind of the buying power of the whole, right? Negotiating with these software vendors on the basis of, you know, the whole versus just CIS as an organization purchasing this. And so that helps bring our costs down, or the way we manage and operate the organization proper, but especially kind of our onboarding and our SOC components and making them as kind of efficient as possible. Because what we're trying to do is, you know, provide the best customer service we can, the security that's going to provide the most value, but at a cost that is cost effective. So the other way we kind of turn this model on its head is when you buy endpoint security software, your price is based on how many endpoints you have, right? So if you have 100 endpoints, you pay X per endpoint. If you have 10,000 endpoints, you pay a fraction of that per endpoint. But the majority of our members that need, you know, that we are trying to satisfy or serve with the service are very small. So when we went into this, one of my primary objectives on the cost and the price model was I want to get this price as low as we can for everybody. So now these little guys that have 100 endpoints or 200 endpoints, they're going to pay that price of those that are now today only getting that price if they have 10,000 endpoints or 50,000 endpoints, right? So, and that's exactly what we built. And, you know, we're just about 2 years into that program, and we are now protecting over 500 organizations with that service. And we're continuing to expand it today, actually. As we speak, we're working to build out some more things based on what we're hearing back from the members. But the price point we were able to go out with, the partnership with the commercial organization, the simplicity of buying it and installing it, and then what we offer, just, it's, you know, you're looking at the whole picture, not just a piece of it. So I hope that helped, Tony, or somewhat answered it.
No, there's lots of examples in there, you know, of the both understanding, again, the need from the customer side, their ability to manage solutions, but also put it, you know, aggregate enough of the demand to make it worthwhile for the vendor, right, to say, okay. And I think, you know, that's been one of the things that you've really focused on, you know, for those vendors to go after small dollar customers is just not worth it. Right? They're knocking on a lot of doors to make a small number of sales. But if we can aggregate that demand in such a way that consolidates, you know, makes it simpler in terms of the offering, their reach into the customer base and the value that we provide, you know, from the operational understanding side. And I think there's a, you know, win there for everybody. I think that's how that has worked out.
Well, Gina, that's the end of the episode, if you can believe it. I think we're going to need to have you back on some thoughts and some elements that you've presented here. I think the hacker mindset that you have, changing the game, as it were, in terms of these business models is phenomenal. It's a new way of thinking in a way that we can address the need. And I think that's obviously, it's all mission. And so thank you very much.
It keeps it fun, too. It keeps it fun.
Keeping vendors on their toes. I love it. Well, thank you, Gina. I really appreciate it.
Thank you guys both. It's good to see you and Tony, as always.
Thank you. And you, Tony, great work as well. Thank you so much. And really to our audience, thank you. Remember to subscribe in all the usual ways. Catch the episodes at The CI Security on YouTube. And with that, we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today.
The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS.
Tune in on Wednesdays for a new episode. And in the meantime, visit our website at cisecurity.org.
Together, we'll continue our efforts of creating confidence in the connected world.